On air, online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Have you got brothers or sisters? Would you ever go into business with them? On today's show, we're casting rivalries aside and meeting the siblings who have made it work.
Yeah, you've got to have a really good relationship. You've got to be able to speak honestly with each other, and because we've got to work it out that, you know, we're all getting our share, and you've got to have a stable relationship, let's say that.
The sad reality of the dry conditions in Western Australia.
That tells me how dry it is and how much the West Australian sector and particularly sheep producer there is suffering. I just saw on Twitter this morning a farmer's digging a pit to shoot animals because he can't sell them, no buyer. And I think that's the story there. It's a very different picture in the west to the east.
And passion fruit season in Northern Australia. Find out how this fruit is produced. Did you know a lot of passion fruit is actually harvested off the ground? Lots to talk about today. What sort of passion fruit do you have in your garden, and when is the season down here? Are you seeing them right now? Send me a text. Let me know, 0438 922936. Now, would you go into business with your brother or sister? Family-run operations are pretty common in agriculture, but like with any business partnership, they can have their ups and downs. Dana and Grace and Lester purchased their first livestock and cropping property together 18 months ago at Bishopsbourne in the Northern Midlands. Larissa Smith spoke to the school teacher and welder about striking the right balance to farm together.
Pop and his brother originally bought it a bit over 70 years ago. Pop's been here ever since. After a few years, him and his brother split it, so we now currently have what would have been Trevor's half, and we've bought that off another person who had it in between, who's been here for about the last 40 or so years. But yeah, between Grace and Charlie and I, we're now taking on this part as well.
Describe what the property consists of and its layout.
We're trying to be fairly diverse at the moment in terms of our operation and what we're doing here at the moment. We obviously all live here together. It's basically the best way for it to all happen and for us to be able to manage it. So we do manage a bit of livestock. So we've got some sheep and cattle, as well as a bit of cropping with a variety of crops in, depending on year on year what's best to do in that space.
I did an apprenticeship as a boilermaker welder starting, it was nearly 10 years ago now. Ever since, I've sort of been progressing and helping Pop out after work and whatnot. And then with the opportunity to buy this place, we've sort of jumped into it a bit. And now I've cut back to just the 2 days or whatever I can fit in the welding. The farm's getting more and more involved now, which is making it harder to get to work. But that's all right. We're doing enough. So, yeah, and in that, we're trying to mix the operation up and diversify the risk where we can, and that's the theory behind the mixed operation. And then we're trying to find markets for the crossbred calves, dairy beef sort of stuff as well, which is sort of fits in with my father's operation, which is a dairy up the northeast. And that in turn, you know, with the bobby calf situation at the moment, I think is pretty important for the where the state's at, and hopefully we can keep working through that and do a better job as we go. And then the cropping, well, it's always evolving and what we think we should be doing. And, you know, the more and more we do, hopefully the better we get. And it's more about diversifying the risk and organising cash flow and that sort of stuff and trying to get the work done.
How important have your parents been in your transition into farming as siblings and also with Dana's partner Charlie on board too?
Fairly pivotal, I'd say. We definitely wouldn't have the opportunity to buy the farm off our own equity, so their support has been very much appreciated. Confidence, knowledge. There's been a lot of phone calls, late nights, and machinery borrowing and that sort of stuff. I don't think it's ever been easy to get into farming, but now I'd say land and machinery price relative to commodity price is probably at its peak, or the highest it's been in a long time anyway. But we're fortunate enough to have the confidence and the backing of everyone around us to jump in, and And we're not the only ones doing it. There's a few other guys around, young people getting about, trying to get into, and there's different avenues to go in, whether it's share farming or even just working up through a management op to a management stage and then purchasing or gaining equity as you're working for someone. It's difficult, but I think we've got the figures right and I think we can make it work, which is good.
So, Charlie, you're the financial brains behind this trio. How good are you on budgeting?
First of all, I'm the import here. I'm not the original Tasmanian, so I've tried to, utilise a bit of my background skills. I studied agri at Melbourne there, and through that gained a role in the agri-finance sector, and that relocated me down to Tassie, to Lonnie, and probably originally thought it was only going to be a three-month stint and then fly back out, but I settled in the place pretty well. Lonnie was just an unreal spot to live and work, and I joined a footy club and, made some really good friends there. Fortunately, met my partner Dane there as well. But utilising, the agri skill set's probably, something I try to bring to the table. There's still a lot to learn. I'm pretty fortunate with my customer base through the Cressy and Northern Midlands sector. There's a lot I can learn off them, particularly on how they're financially modelling their businesses and how to apply similar methods to here. We're really fortunate, though. We are surrounded with, we have a great accountant that we've utilised. He really helped us set up our structure. So it is like that communication and all that works really well, and equal share and portions work quite well. You surround yourself with good people and you can make a lot of things work really well. So we're very fortunate with who we've got around us, even with Ted's experience here and Reed's as well. They've both been here for a very long time and have farmed right at both sides of the road, and they know the land really well and what works and when the floods come and what to look out for. And we've got to pick their brains as much as we can to adjust and learn, and hence probably we are doing a lot more cropping than we originally thought we would. But when you look around the district, that's what seems to be occurring and what seems to be making the greater return, and balancing that with your livestock aspect, because it does fluctuate the markets and you've got to ride the highs with the lows. And but if you have that diversity with the cropping side and the cattle and the sheep, well, you can find a way through it. So we're pretty fortunate.
Would you recommend going into business with a sibling?
Yeah, you've got to have a really good relationship. You've got to be able to speak honestly with each other. And because, I might be doing majority of the on-farm work, but we've got to work it out that, we're all getting our share. And I think everyone's putting in the hours. So as long as you've got to have a stable relationship, let's say that.
There's not a whole lot of time between us. We're only 15 months apart in terms of when we were born. So we've grown up with each other for a long time and sort of been each other's best friends for a long time too. So I get that probably not every sibling relationship is like that. And if you don't have that, then it probably makes it really hard. And we're pretty fortunate that we've seen our parents work pretty hard and what that can do. And I think that probably dictates how we work or how we attack our lives as well. Like young people going forward, you've got to be prepared to put in some long hours. You've got to be prepared to sacrifice something. And at the end of the day, we're all sacrificing different things, but you've got to enjoy it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worth it in the end.
How does it make you feel to see your grandchildren taking on the property that's been in the family so long?
How do I feel? I feel all right. I don't have to do so much now.
Do you think they're doing a pretty good job?
Yeah, I think they're doing a good job, yes. We wasn't well off for money when we bought it, but it soon paid for itself. Pretty good land about here. I think they'll handle it all right. They're doing it all right so far.
And that was 91-year-old Ted Bricknell. Pop to Dana and Grace and Lester at Bishopsbourne near Carrick in the Northern Midlands. You also heard from Charlie Fry as well. Now, in the picturesque town of Flowerpot, just 40 minutes out of Hobart, it was an easy decision for brothers Matthew and Jonathan Hughes to work together. Winemaker Johnny took some time between pressing grapes to chat to reporter Meg Whitfield about what makes the sibling operation work.
I think without my brother we wouldn't be in this endeavour. The wine grape business requires some capital and I don't have any. I think the decision to buy the vineyard I think was a bit of a way for Matt to move on from his very busy life in Sydney and come back to Tasmania. And then the way the business evolved was very organic, and it grew up and probably caught us both by surprise a little bit. We probably anticipated the Mewstone part of it. We didn't really anticipate the Hughes & Hughes part of it for the first 5 years until we started to pick some grapes and realised we didn't really have enough, and I wanted a full-time job out of it. So I convinced Matt to let me buy more grapes, and we started the Hughes & Hughes half of the business, which is probably more than half of the business these days. So, yeah, I think it's something that in a good way just grew up really organically, and so it always made sense. The next step always made sense.
A lot of people say, you know, there's that old adage of you don't choose your family. In this instance, you did choose to go down this path and actually build a business together. Why did you have the confidence that that dynamic was going to work?
I think we've always been a reasonably close family. I don't think we, you know, if we have a big family Christmas, I don't think there's too much stress in the kitchen. Everyone sort of just picks their job, does their job, passes off the job that needs doing to someone else in the family. If you know your brother's better at, you know, doing some brickwork, then let him build mum and dad's brick, the steps at the front of the house. Don't do it yourself. I hear the story a lot. How do you work with your brother? And I always think, well, it's not very hard. Yeah, we talk a lot, and that probably is pretty key. It might seem that we talk excessively, but I think it's a pretty good key to making sure you're on the same page and you know what each other's thinking. You're not trying to guess.
How do you divvy up the roles? How do you decide who's responsible for which aspect of the vineyard of the business?
I guess that's probably been one of the things that's been really clear and easy the whole way through with us, is that the winemaking side, so the grapes and the wine, that was my specialty. So when it comes to ideas of how we're going to make the wine, Matt doesn't come in and say, oh, you should do this, because I think he understands, like, no, that's your job. And likewise, when it comes to doing the accounts, I don't tell Matt how to do the accounts because he's got way more experience at that than I do. We both had a similar background at uni. So I did economics and Matt did finance and accounting. And so I think that helps us a little bit, because if you like, the brains don't work in too dissimilar fashion. So when we talk, we are on the same wavelength a lot of the time. Just, you know, I think we both take after Dad a little bit. But the roles are really clearly defined when it comes to the, if you like, Matt's the GM. He's the one that has to look after the business side of it, and we'll talk through all the things so we both know what each other's doing. But that's his role. My side is looking after the winemaking and the sales, because the sales has always been something that through my career before this was always a key part of what I'd done in my roles. So can make it, can sell it, and Matt can do everything else.
You mentioned before you've always been a close family. Who's the older sibling?
Matthew's the older sibling, which makes a lot of sense. He's the bossy one, and I'm the youngest, so there's two in the middle. So there's four boys in our family. The other two have doing their own thing. They're not really involved, other than when we need a hand picking some grapes or something. But no, Matt's the oldest and I'm the youngest. So I guess when we were kids in the backyard playing sport, we had to be a team back then too, when I think back to it. So yeah, if it was 2-on-2 cricket in the backyard, oldest and youngest versus the middle two was the standard makeup of the teams. So I guess we have been a team since I can remember. He'd say he's been helping me, but you know, I was always undervalued.
And how do you manage if there is a conflict that does come up?
We've had very few in absolute truth. We've had a couple of times that I can remember where we genuinely have been slightly tense, and normally over a mistake that someone's made or something like that. But I think ultimately if we really, really get tense, then everyone just retreats, speaks to mum and dad separately, and mum and dad tell us what the other one really thought, maybe lead us in the right direction. When you do make a mistake, and we've made lots along the way, there is no point dwelling on the mistake. Very quickly, we both turn to mistake made, how do we fix? And half of those mistakes, to be perfectly honest, have actually ended up in better outcomes.
So it's something you'd recommend for other families? Don't be too scared to work with your siblings?
No, not if you're good communicators, if you enjoy each other's company, then absolutely not. I would probably rather work with a family member than a friend, to be perfectly honest, because I think at the end of the day, we absolutely know that if there is any conflict, we're still going to have to sit down at Christmas. So we're still going to have to sit down at mum and dad's dinner table. Personally, I think I'd find it more challenging to work with a really good mate, because you can find a new friend. Can't find new family.
That is true. And that was reporter Meg Whitfield sitting with Johnny Hughes at Mewston Wines. Now, Meg also went a few minutes up the road to the sheep cheese dairy operation Grandview, which operates as a family affair between mother, brother and sister. Co-executive director Nicole Gilliver spoke to Meg and says it's not for everyone, but they've really made it work.
I often describe this business as the glue that sticks the family together, because we come from a very modern, bolted-on family of sorts, if you like. My brother is my half-brother, so we have different fathers, with the common denominator obviously being the matriarch of the family. And I guess because we were born so far apart, we had very different things going on at different life stages, and that essentially meant that the family itself, with the fractious nature that divorce brings and so on and so forth, really essentially the family business itself was the glue that stuck us together. Without the business, there's no way in the world we'd be as close as we are, that's for sure.
And how does that work day to day? What does that dynamic look like?
Originally, we had to work out how to coexist between the three of us, because for a long, long time, until we all moved south from Queensland to work in the business together, we hadn't really existed together in cohabitation as you'd, you know, commonly perceive it amongst family members. I was at university, Ryan was at school, Mum was working, and then, you know, I moved out of home and Ryan grew up in theory, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't until we moved down here that we actually had something to amalgamate us that kind of forced us into understanding what the family was and how to relate to each other in close confines.
Is it something that you do think has really strengthened that relationship even outside of work?
Yeah, totally. Look, that's a question that we get asked a lot, whether or not we socialise together or not. We, in fact, not only do we socialise together regularly, but we also take family holidays together, interestingly enough. Both my brother and I have children. They are not only close in age, but they're close with regards to their relationships, and we often, three generations of us, go on annual leave together when we can. The important caveat, I guess, on that is that we do things separately. That's a super important function of being highly functional within a family business. But we absolutely plan spare time together.
And in terms of the actual breakdown of work, how do you actually define each other's roles, and how has that happened?
Yeah, it's pretty loose. And at first it took us, all three of us, a while to figure out what we were respectively meant to be doing. You know, gears were grinding a little bit for a while, and it wasn't until we figured out between the three of us which lanes we preferred to swim in that things became a lot easier. Now we've all found our natural points of interest within the business, some of which are naturally occurring, the business side of things, the sales side of things, all of those elements that are necessary are sort of fulfilled either by myself, Ryan or Mum in different capacities. But it's taken a long time for us to figure out what that looks like.
And one of the main questions that often comes up when people talk about family businesses is, how do you manage conflict?
Yeah, look, historically it's been pretty poorly managed. Ryan and I in particular had to figure out how we communicate effectively without conflict. That took a long time. We have very different generational spins on what work-life balance is. There are elements of personal choices that obviously impact on your ability to perform what you need to do within a business. And in a family business, I think, well, with the in the context of our business, we give each other a lot of latitude to figure out our personal lives. And, you know, it's a family at the end of the day. So, as Ryan says, you want to be invited back to Christmas Day.
For people who might be thinking about going down this road of going into business with a sibling, with family, is it something you would recommend? What kind of advice do you wish you'd had before you'd all stepped into this?
No. Oh, look, it's not for everyone. It has its benefits and its drawbacks. But I will tell you that when the chips are down, personally and in business, and sometimes it happens at the same time, you need them in your corner and you need them close by, because business, small businesses, family businesses by nature are, you know, the biggest employers in the country, but we're the bottom of the food chain when it comes to a lot of the stuff we have to deal with legislatively and whatnot. And when you operate those things as a sole operator and you don't have a close business partner or a family member to bounce those things off, it can be very isolating and you can feel very alone. And I don't wish that on anyone. So I guess in that instance, being in a family business is not only galvanising, but it's fortifying when the chips are down. You know, so long as you can manage those relationships positively, it can be a very, very, very galvanising force.
And that was Grandview Cheese's Nicole Gilliver speaking with Meg Whitfield. And if you want to have a look at a story with those people, have a look at the ABC Tasmania online page, and there's the story by Larissa Smith and Meg Whitfield, and some great family photos. Now, we've spoken a lot about the dry lately. It's dry in so many places around the state, from King Island down through to Cygnet in the south. A lot of organisations and even individuals are having problems sourcing reasonably priced feed. And we spoke to Bonorong recently also about people bringing in injured native animals because they're getting closer to roads and getting injured. Another organisation that is really feeling the dry is Brightside Farm Sanctuary. We've got Emma Haswell on the line. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Fiona.
Thanks for joining the Country Hour. Now, how are you sort of seeing this dry? I suppose it's on your farm, but in other ways as well.
Yeah. I've never ever seen the Huon Valley like this ever. Sorry.
Water, they want to join in.
Arriving. I have never seen it this dry, and we've never had this many people asking to surrender animals. It's a daily thing.
Right. So what are they saying to you?
They're saying that they cannot afford to buy feed and that there is no feed available. So I know with us, I bought 200 round bales like we normally would, and then normally I would buy square bales as well, but we couldn't get any. So we have our normal amount of hay pretty much, and we've bought another property, so we've got an extra 36 acres, and I still think we're going to be in trouble even though we've got all that extra.
A bit later in the year when you might run out.
If we don't have a good spring, we'll be in trouble. And that's, we've never been in that situation before. We've got a massive hay shed. But I'm really concerned because it's not just, you know, people can't afford it. It's not that. It's that there is none to buy, no hay to buy. So,
What sort of animals are people surrendering?
They're asking me to take horses, ponies, goats and sheep so far, and it's every day.
And how are you going for space and the ability to look after them?
I've had to say no. I basically, the farrier was laughing at me this morning and said, you know, they told someone I would only take their horse if it was emaciated, so they'd better put it on a diet. And, you know, it's that case. It's sad. I can only take the really bad cruelty cases at the moment, because we've already had 7 starving horses surrendered to us this year, and 3, I think, of those had a body score of 0 out of 9.
Wow.
So it's been horrific. It's been absolutely, it's been terrible. Very, very upsetting.
What are you able to give anyone any advice? I mean, what do you say to people if they're running short of hay, they've got a couple of horses in the paddock or goats or sheep? They're going to have to go to grain or?
The grain, and I guess with cattle you can use straw and pea straw, and, you know, some animals can eat straw, and you just supplement that with lick blocks, but it's going to be very hard to supply roughage to horses and things if this continues. And it's a terrible, terrible thing to see.
Mm. So not really taking any more except, you know, really bad cases.
I'm taking some. If I know I can ring home them, yes, then I'll take them. And if they're really, really suffering and neglected, but it's terrible, really hard to say no to people when, yes, they've got pet animals, pet sheep and pet goats, and they don't know what to do with them. I've never been in this position before where we've been asked to take so many.
So any advice out there apart from, you know, trying licks, trying different types of feed?
I think it's a very sad thing to say, but if you have old horses and you can't supply them with feed, it really is kinder to get the vet to put them to sleep rather than leave them to starve. And we're seeing so many starving horses and hungry horses already that would be my advice. And normally I would never say that, but this year I think it's a case of being kind,
yes,
you know, to the animal.
It's not just the price, it's the fact that there's not much feed out there.
Yeah,
it's
if you can't get hay, it's going to be a nightmare for people.
Emma Haswell, look, good luck with everything that's going on there at Brightside, and thanks so much for joining the Country Hour.
Thank you, Fiona.
Time now for the news headlines with Loretta Loberger.
Good afternoon, Fiona. Health Minister Guy Barnett says he's arranging a roundtable with key medical stakeholders to discuss new protocols aimed at stopping ambulance ramping. From today, patients arriving at Tasmanian hospitals in an ambulance should be transferred into the care of the hospital within an hour. The change has prompted concerns from hospital staff, who say more resources are required for the new target to be met. Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers says he's worried Medicare funding for GPs is being eaten up by state and territory payroll taxes. The Royal Australian College of GPs says the Commonwealth's $3.5 billion investment into bulk billing is being lost under changes to payroll tax, which now covers GPs. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says Israeli strikes on the southern city of Rafah over the weekend have killed 22 people, including 18 children. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has warned his army will soon step up its attacks. It comes as ceasefire talks have come to a standstill and as the US is set to approve billions of dollars of additional military aid to Israel. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Loretta. Time now to cross to the Weather Bureau. And hello, Michael Conway.
Hi, Fiona.
Now, we're going to get a chance to see you in person. What's only a week away, isn't it, till Agfest?
Yeah, I was just looking at the long-range weather forecast for that.
Is it looking okay?
It's looking good. Yeah, just partly cloudy there and not much chance of rain.
I think we've been pretty lucky in the last few years. It's been okay at Agfest. Sometimes get a little bit cold, but touch wood. But people can actually see what you look like.
They're in for a treat.
They're in for a treat. Tall, really tall, dark.
Oh, dear.
They'll see what I look like too. I don't know. It might be. Don't expect big things, okay, everyone? Now to the weather. Can you tell me, has there been much rainfall overnight?
No, there was a few light showers about the west and southwest. Matsaika Island was the top at 3 millimetres, and Marawara had 2 millimetres as well. And there's been no significant rainfall in the gauges, although there's been a few very light falls about the west since 9 a.m.
And what can we expect with the outlook?
Yeah, so at the moment there's a fair bit of low cloud, a little bit more than perhaps was expected about the north coast right at the moment, and that should continue into tomorrow, so it'll likely be cloudy about the north and also the west. And then tomorrow evening we're getting a cold front coming through, and it'll bring showers statewide. It'll be 10 to 20 millimetres around the west, that sort of a range, and then for the rest of the state it's more like 2 to 5 millimetres. So it'll bring some light showers for most of the state on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. And then we're back to, the main thing after that will be it'll be a cool change. So temperatures will drop down 3 to 6 degrees. Hobart's looking at a maximum of 15 on Wednesday and Thursday. So very relatively cool from what we've been having, and that's pretty much statewide as well. So cool, and then back to just more settled weather towards the end of the week.
Okay. Any warnings at all?
We do. It's a bit windy about tomorrow with the front, so there's plenty of warnings there. But for today, we've just got a strong wind warning about northeastern waters from Cape Portland to Wineglass Bay, and for southern waters from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point. For tomorrow, we've got gale warnings about out for the far northwest and southwest coasts. There's strong wind warnings out for all other coastal waters apart from east of Flinders Island and Bank Strait and Franklin Sound. We've also got strong wind warnings for the central plateau and southwest lakes and all the southeast coastal inshore waters.
What else can we expect on coastal waters and swell?
Yeah, so generally the winds today will be northwesterly at 15 to 25 knots, increasing to 20 to 30 knots about the south this afternoon, and about northeastern and western waters during the evening. The winds tomorrow, northwesterly is 15 to 25 knots, reaching up to 20 to 30 knots about the southwest, and the northeast in the morning, winds tend west to southwesterly throughout 20 to 30 knots, reaching up to 35 knots about the northwest and southwest. The swell's about, for today, in the west and south, we've got a southwesterly at 2 to 3 metres. Tomorrow it's rising up to 2.5 to 3.5 metres, and then even further to 3 to 4 metres in the evening. In the north for both days, westerly up to a metre. And in the east today, 1 to 2 metres southerly, up to 2.5 metres offshore in the south, southwesterly, and in tomorrow it's easing off a little with the more westerly swell around, and generally, and we've got a southerly at 1 to 1.5, but it's reaching up to 3 metres later offshore in the south.
All right, Michael Conway, thanks very much.
Thanks, Fiona.
G'day, it's Leon Compton, and we're out and about.
Now we're talking Hobart.
Tomorrow morning I'll be on Main Road Moona, and on Wednesday in Midtown on Elizabeth Street in Hobart. Come along, share your stories, bring the kids to watch live radio being made, and you'll meet all the candidates asking for your vote in the upcoming Legislative Council elections. Or tune in to hear the people and their stories that make our vibrant spaces hum. Tomorrow and Wednesday on ABC Radio Hobart.
Now, some of the fastest shearers from Wales have put their skills to the test against gun shearers from Australia over the weekend. In a speed shear, competitors have to shear just one sheep as quickly and as cleanly as possible, with the fastest on the night getting the wool off in under 22 seconds. It's a growing sport in the UK, and a team from Wales travelled to Wagga Wagga to take part in a competition on the weekend. But Welsh shearers Geithan Lewis and Elon Jones told Emily Doak they got in some practice in an Aussie shearing shed first.
Thought we'd better get a bit of practice in. Having none of us been to Australia before, so we're lucky enough to have a couple of stands with Muddy Shearing, based from Dubbo. But yeah, we've been shearing a few merinos, so experiencing a bit of the Aussie shearing culture that way. We've had a bit of banter, but nothing too serious, so we've got on real well. A bit of fun.
Now tell me a little bit about the type of sheep that you have back home in Wales that you work with. How are they different to the merinos of Australia?
Start off, there's no wrinkles. That's a big bonus. We've found that hard to get used to. You don't really have to think much by shearing the sheep of UK, but with these merinos, your left hand has to be working all the time, and has to keep a flat comb, not ride out like we've been doing in the shed. But the sheep are generally more open. Not much belly wool, no top knots, nothing. They're pretty fast shearing, and coming over here and shearing 35 runs breaks your heart a bit, but it's okay.
And so the breeds of these sheep, what are they?
Welsh mules, the actual Welsh breed itself. They're more like smaller mountain type sheep. Yeah, there's Cheviots, there's a few Romneys, but there's so many breeds in Britain. You could be shearing 5 different breeds a day and 10 different breeds in a week.
Recently, size flock, 1,000 sheep, you'd be doing good. Usually around the 500-600 mark, but then a lot of farmers now 200-300, so a lot of setups in a day, it'd be 3-4 setups if you've got 3 decent shearers. Yeah, so it's a lot of moving about and shearing in the sun in the paddock. Yeah, it's total different to the sheds out here.
You'd be a lot more mobile, smaller flocks to shear only, And as you say, setting up and shearing in the paddocks rather than a shed.
Yeah, we've all got mobile trailers and they're getting better now that these race trailers come over from Ireland. It makes our job much easier. The hard thing is when the weather raining, we haven't got much cover.
Wouldn't rain much there though, would it?
Yeah, well, we've had a good 4 or 5 months rain now, so...
Hopefully we'll be right for a bit.
Yeah.
Has the industry, sheep and wool industry, generally changed much in Wales since Brexit?
I think it has. It's given the younger shearers an opportunity to go shearing. Before COVID, all the foreign shearers would come in and there wasn't much stands for them. And now they've all had a chance to... Shear and they're gaining on us now, so we have to pull our finger out.
I suppose looking at the speed shear sport in Wales, is that something that's pretty popular?
Yeah, definitely. It's getting stronger and stronger every year. It's really kicked off as a big sport over in Wales and in the UK. It's good to see. It's good for the industry, and there's a lot of top competitors coming through now. But no, it's enjoyable. That's what you want to be. You want to be competing against the best every week.
Yeah, it's all competitive on the board, but again, off the board, having a few beers after, yeah, we're all good friends.
So how do you think you're going to go here in Australia today against the Wagga team?
I think we've got a pretty good chance. We'll give it our best. We've had a lot of knowledge off these local people, what combs to use, and hopefully we'll pull off and have a win, yeah.
Yeah, feeling confident. We'll wear our Welsh singlets and badge of pride, and hopefully we'll do our best, make Wales proud, and take a win home.
And they did come away with that win. Fantastic news for the Welsh team that travelled so far. And we've got a couple of texts in, one from Stuart saying, why is the Tasmanian drought not national news? This is on par with other natural disasters. Mainland Australia doesn't normally associate Tasmania with drought, but we are an incredibly dry state. That's Stuart Tanner. What can we do to help Brightside? I can send you some details. Really, the only way to help is to probably donate so they can buy more hard feed, being grain and that sort of thing. And sibling story for you. When our eldest kids were young, we visited Grandview Cheese. Standing on the balcony looking down at the sheep in the paddock, our daughter said to her brother, "See the sheep with the blue stripe on their back? Those are the ones the blue cheese comes from." And that was CJ. That's a good one. Now, a huge amount of lamb is travelling from drought-stricken areas of Western Australia to the east coast, to farms with feed or to processors with capacity. It's a long drive and a costly exercise for WA farmers to sell lambs to the east coast, but it highlights the difficult conditions that farmers there face and the lack of markets they can sell to. Livestock analyst Mark Dalgleish says more lamb has been driven east in 2024 so far than in the entirety of 2023.
We're actually seeing some strong flows as of the start of 2024. So first 2 months of 2024, we had as many transferred west to east in that first 2 months as what we saw the whole of 2023.
Wow, so all last year, all the numbers of sheep that came from Western Australia across to the eastern states in 2023, you've already hit that number in the first 2 months of this
correct,
year.
Correct, correct. And we've just seen the March numbers release today, and there's another 120,000 odd that came across in March. So it was about 220,000 for the first 2 months, and now we've had another 120 on that. So it's going to be a strong year for those transfers if these numbers keep kind of continuing through the year.
What does that tell you as an analyst?
Well, A, that there's a discount in price that can make it worthwhile to send that many, because, you know, normally you don't see anywhere near those flows west to east every single year. That tells me how dry it is and how much the West Australian sector and particularly the sheep producer there is suffering. I just saw on Twitter this morning a farmer's digging a pit to shoot animals because he can't sell them, no buyer. And I think that's the story there. It's a very different picture in the west to the east.
Does that show that there's not enough killing capacity in Western Australia to take these excess animals?
Yeah, in terms of well, capacity to process there, but also as part of that too would be, you know, any alternative markets. So it could be domestic processing and kind of value adding completely, or it could be the bag market, which I think you spoke about last week as well, that Middle Eastern kill market, or where it's a whole carcass. So we're not doing as much value add here, but the animals are still being slaughtered here and then shipped usually to the Middle East fairly quickly. So yeah, that's one of the big hurdles that we've got to get over if we're going to move away from LiveX.
How expensive is it to get lambs from west to east? I can't imagine it's a cheap process.
You've got to have the cost factor there in terms of the discount to make it worth your while. Now, it does depend on the size of the animal. So if you're talking a 55-kilo sheep, so a heavier sheep, you have less on the transport because of the size of that. So that you're talking about $50 a head to get them across the Nullarbor. And if you're talking a lighter lamb, like 35-kilo, because you can get more of them on, it reduces the per-head cost. So they're about a $45 charge to get them across.
That's expensive when you're looking at that per head. That must mean significant discounts to Western Australians.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We see when that discount widens enough in WA so that you can cover the cost of transport plus potentially have a little bit of extra just in case for anything unforeseen, or, you know, when you're organising the transport, the margin's there, but when you go to do it, you know, the prices change a bit. So you've got to allow for some of that as well, a bit of slippage. But, yeah, that's the key driver, is that discount widening enough to make it worthwhile to do the transport.
Prices have been fluctuating, I think it's fair to say, even on the East Coast. Does the influx of WA sheep and lambs affect the prices here?
Yeah, even with those volumes into the hundreds of thousands, we're not talking, you know, significant enough volumes to flood markets here. You probably could see that there's some level of discounting, but you're probably talking cents in the kilo rather than large amounts. And to see the really strong flows like we saw in 2020, when it was that whole year, it was 1.9 million head, that's significant flows. But you've got to have not just a price discount, you've also got to have really strong demand and restocker demand, which we're not really seeing that in the East now. We saw the lack of confidence in the market last year and how, you know, that flooded our market a bit and the price responded accordingly. This year we've seen a pickup in confidence, but we're not restocking strongly in that sheep flock. So, the demand has to be there just underlying as well as the discount.
Live export isn't banned yet. Why hasn't live export then just taken up these extra numbers of sheep being offloaded in WA?
It isn't banned yet, you're right, but we do have pretty much 4 months of the year where it's not operational in the Northern Hemisphere summer, and we're just about to hit that. You know, mid-May, is when that shuts down effectively, and then it doesn't open again until about mid-September. So that's going to be another added issue for the West Australian producer. It's one market then that won't be there for that part of the year. So that's been problematic, and we have seen historically since 2018 when that moratorium began over the summer, the Northern Hemisphere summer, we know that the discount widens through that period of time. Almost every year we've seen that. The only year we didn't was the year when we had the 1.9 million come across to the east, when New South Wales was in a real strong rebuild phase.
Matt Dalglish is with you. So let's talk about the other issue with the Middle East trade over the last couple of weeks. We saw the initial phase, which sort of has cooled since, but is still there, between Iran launching weapons against Israel, grounding flights, and effectively grounded the bag lamb trade, which is carcasses flying to the Middle East. And we saw immediate price discounts at Victorian sale yards. Is that the kind of thing that will have the lamb industry on edge for a little bit of time?
It will, and it had a bit of an impact too, because capacity was already tight for that air freight market. If you look back to before COVID, the average kind of per tonnage that was going out on Australian planes a day to the Middle East predominantly in a bag market sense was about 160 tonne, and nowadays it's around the 60 tonne, so it's significantly reduced. And then if you overlay then some cancelled flights into that destination because of safety concerns, then that just made that availability shrink even more, and it is really hard to get space on that for carcass.
So it's really hard to get space. Is that just because there's a limited amount of flights going that way from Australia?
Correct, yep, absolutely. And obviously through COVID, you know, when we had less passenger transport, we had to actually organise a few dedicated freight ones to send them as a dedicated shipment, whereas, you know, most of the time they'll piggyback on the passenger flights. And we've had, you know, reduced passenger transport. The numbers have come back now that all the borders have opened again, but there are other things, factors like increased efficiency in the airlines. We're now having flights that can go direct from Perth or Darwin straight into London. They don't need to do a stopover in Abu Dhabi, and that just means that we're really reliant on the trips that are coming from the Middle East to Australia and then returning back again, because if we've got regular trips coming, we can piggyback on those passenger trips with carcass in the bottom of the plane.
And that was livestock analyst Matt Dalgleish. Time for a little bit of music now.
Tell me something, girl. Are you happy in this modern world? Or do you need more? Is there something else you're searching for? I'll fall in all the good times I find myself longing for change, and in the bad times I fear myself.
Tell me something, boy. Aren't you tired trying to fill that void? Or do you need more? Ain't it hard keeping it so hardcore? I'm falling. In all the good times I find myself longing for change. And in the bad times I fear myself.
Hope you had a nice little sing-along while you're eating your lunch. And just finally today, passion fruit is one of the few crops that growers pick almost year-round. And last financial year, Australian farmers produced about 4,700 tonnes of fruit, valued at $29 million. But it's a challenging fruit to grow, as Jen Nichols discovered when she headed out to a field day and caught up with Dennis Chant, the president of Passion Fruit Australia.
These vines here would be 18 months old, and those ones there would be about 8 or 9 months old. So they planted them last October. This is what we call the sweetheart, and that was for the more southern areas like Sunshine Coast and the Tweed, where I come from. The sweetheart for many years has been the stock standard, but it's hybrid and it's been losing its vigour. So we've been through the Horticulture Innovation Australia and our levy funds trying to do a new breeding program, and it hasn't been overly successful, but we've just recently relet the program to University of Queensland based at the research station up there at Nambour. So I think their approach seems to be much more scientific. So we're having a look at some of the vines today that they're progressing. So we've got great hope that that program will start producing some new varieties in a couple of years.
Yes, I actually got to go and interview the researchers last year when they won that contract. So it was really interesting. Now, Dennis Chant, you were the president of Passion Fruit Australia, and we are in a passion fruit field at Beerburrum. Now, oh gosh, gorgeous day, lots of fruit that's looking pretty good. But how has the weather in the last few years been affecting the crops?
Before last year, we all in the southeast Queensland and Tweed, we had real problems from all of that really wet 2022 year. You know, we all had big floods and a lot of the vines from fungal diseases just keeled over. I think having a really dry year last year has really helped us get back again. We had a lot of really hot weather caused a lot of the fruit to drop off. But now with the cooler and getting a bit of drier weather, we're actually now getting a really good fruit set. So there should be quite a bit of fruit coming on in the next month or two.
So the rain this year, we've had a lot of it here on the Sunshine Coast. Have you been getting much fungal disease?
We've been able to manage it. It hasn't been bad as a couple of years ago. So I think getting the vines established during that dry period has given them a good start. And we've had to work pretty hard to keep the fungal diseases down. But managing fungus is really one of the key themes of today's field day. So we're looking at new products that have actually been tested by one of the chemical companies on our property. And that's coming out really good. So we've got a limited armoury at the moment. You can't keep repeating the same treatments all the time because you get resistance within the fungicide. So we're looking at new products. There's people that look at soil health, utilising the health of the soil to eliminate some of the need to spray chemicals for fungicides. So coming at it from a number of prongs. Also today we've got a researcher from University of Queensland who's giving us a presentation on how to more accurately identify the different types of fungal diseases, because there's a myriad of them, and actually trying to identify the right one so that you get the right treatment is one of the challenges. So that's a very big theme for today as well.
What about beneficial insects? Do you use many of them on the crops?
Yeah, indeed. Today, another one of the presenters is a gentleman from a company called Bugs for Bugs. We use them particularly for mites and scale and other insect pests. A lot of the growers are trying to go that way and minimise, again, the use of chemicals. Unfortunately, with fungus, we don't have any, we're trying to move to more natural products. But, you know, apart from soil health and looking at these natural products, the current armoury is more limited to chemicals, whereas with insect pests, beneficial bugs are quite prevalent now. We've tried to limit the use of herbicides and that to try and encourage more microbial activity in the soil. To go fully that way is a huge challenge, but I think it's the way of the future, and everybody will be looking at that. I think a lot more producers of different products are trying to go that way,
And that was Dennis Chant, the president of Passion Fruit Australia. And we had a text in. Hi, Joel Reinberg.
Hello.
Hello. We had a text in about someone who was growing passion fruit. Gosh, it's right down here now. I had about 40 kilos of passion fruit about 6 weeks ago off three varying intermingled vines. Then because of the dry summer, the vines started dying and now I've ripped them all out. Oh, Phil, that's Phil at Primrose Sands. But that's a lot of passion fruit, 40 kilos.
That is a lot of passion fruit.
There's been a few in the newsroom, actually, people giving them out. So it must be that time.
Yeah, I've noticed a batch of them at our house that I don't know how they got there. So I suspect my wife, who works in the newsroom, has been picking them up off the table there.
Now, what's happening in your program?
On afternoons today, do you have a favourite cheapo meal?
Oh, probably bolognese or just a Mexican sort of a in wrap type thing.
Basic Mexican in the wraps is hard to beat. Mine is apricot chicken.
Oh, yeah, I've done that for a long time.
Such a simple thing, chicken legs, you know, which is the cheapest cut off the chook, basically.
Yes, yes.
Chicken legs and apricot nectar and French onion soup mix put together and bake in the oven.
That's right.
And serve it with
any
vegetable and any starch you like, and it works. You can have it with rice or potatoes or beans or whatever you want.
I think that's in that cookbook that, you know, Mum handed down.
Well, yeah, look, I actually, when I was at uni, I had a cookbook called Cheap Thrills in the Kitchen.
Cheap Thrills in the Kitchen.
Fantastic name,
I don't know
isn't
if
it?
You should tell me about this book.
But look, this is the update on that. This is a book called $10 Meals with Chelsea, where she reckons that she gets it down to $2.50 a serve.
That's good.
I think you know, if you published this 2 months ago, maybe by now that's no longer accurate. That's the way prices are going.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we're going to talk to her about, for example, the substitutions you can make.
Yeah.
You know, instead of buying this, buy that, and it's very similar, but it costs you half as much. So we're going to talk to her about $10 meals and get some of her favourite recipes on that behalf. We're also going to talk about bushwalking with kids and how to get the kids to enjoy bushwalking. Great article about it that came out by the guy we're talking to. His number one thing on the list, bring lots of lollies.
Yeah, up over
but what
that
are the kids
hill,
gonna
you
eat?
Get a lolly. Oh, fantastic, Joel Reinberger. Thanks very much.
Thank
and
you.
I'll catch you again tomorrow at noon.
The radio station I listen to the most.
ABC Radio Hobart.
936 AM.
ABC Radio Hobart.
Now we're talking.